Okay, let's turn to Genesis chapter 18. Genesis 18, well, Abraham's going to have a visit. We'll look at in chapter 18 from three people who turn out to be more than meets the eye type people. And by way of introduction, Genesis 18 and 19 present the appearance of two angels and Jesus Christ to Abraham. That's who's going to, these three individuals are going to be. God is not going to appear in his glory to Abraham, but he's going to appear as a man, the Jesus Christ pre-incarnate, as we call it. He appears as a man with two friends traveling through Hebron, where Abraham is. Now, they had two purposes. We looked at these last hour. If you'll recall, the first one was to establish Sarah's faith. And we'll find that in verses 1 through 15. Very important that Sarah's faith be established. You notice that in verse 12 when it says, Sarah laughed to herself, saying, after I have become old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? In other words, the angel promised that they would have a son, Abraham and Sarah, and she laughed. She said, I'm too old. In fact, she was past menopause. How are you going to have a kid? Well, it's going to require a miracle, and that's what God is going to provide. So her faith needs to be established. And you can see that her faith was established. If you turn up to Hebrews chapter 11, that this worked. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 11, it says, by faith, even Sarah herself conceived ability to conceive, or received ability to conceive, even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who had promised. So the reprimand that she's about to receive is going to work because she had faith and she conceived her child, Isaac, in faith. And that's the first reason for these visitors. The second, of course, was to announce the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And that'll be in verses 16 through 33. So these three visitors are going to inform Abraham about God's upcoming destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And we noted again last hour also that Genesis 18 is the historical setting for Hebrews 13:2, the doctrine of hospitality. We're going to see that very easily, and as we read through here, remember the Hebrews were having trouble with hospitality, and Genesis chapter 18 is a perfect example of a hospitable person, and that's what is going to be the gist of that. And in fact, 1 through 5 of chapter 18 in Genesis is going to talk about the invitation, and then 6 through 8 are going to point out the activity that Abraham took part in to get to be hospitable to these guys. Now, it's also going to be the answer to the question of Mary in Luke 1:34, and we looked at that again last hour, and that was how can she conceive, how can Elizabeth conceive a child when she's past, well, let's look at that, Luke 1:34. This is a different question than we looked at last hour. Last hour we looked at Elizabeth bearing a child past her childbearing years, and now Mary has a question, and that is in verse 34, where it says, "Mary said to the angel, 'How can this be, since I am a virgin?'" In other words, how can I bear a child, become pregnant, because I'm a virgin? Well, the answer to that is in Genesis chapter 18. And the answer is the same. Look at verse 37. For nothing will be impossible with God. That's the answer to her question. How can she bear a child when she's a virgin? Nothing's impossible with God. How can Elizabeth, in verse 36, and behold, even your relative Elizabeth has also conceived a son in her old age. Now, how could she do that? Well, nothing is impossible with God. And you could subtitle Genesis 18, Nothing is Impossible with God. And the third section in the New Testament is the instruction to wives in 1 Peter 3, 1-6. And that's based on Genesis 18, 12, where it says Sarah laughed to herself. Sarah was not going to be submissive, but she turned submissive when she's reprimanded. And we'll see that. And that's the gist of look at 1 Peter 3. We ought to look at it, even though I looked at it last hour. In 1 Peter 3, 1 through 6, in the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives. As they observe your chaste and respectful behavior, your adornment must not be merely external, braiding the hair and wearing gold jewelry or putting on dresses, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. For in this way, in former times, the holy women also, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husband, just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And you have become her children if you do what is right without being frightened by any fear. So Genesis chapter 18 is the basis for what Peter is saying here. So that brings us then to the first section of chapter 18, which is the appearance of these three people. So let's read verses 1 through 6. Genesis 18, verse 1. Now the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre while he was sitting at the tent door in the heat of the day. When he lifted up his eyes and looked, behold, three men were standing opposite him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth and said, My Lord, if now I have found favor in your sight, please do not pass your servant by. Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree, and I will bring you a piece of bread that you may refresh yourselves. After that, you may go on since you have visited your servant. And they said, So do as you have said. So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah and said, Quickly, prepare three measures of fine flour and knead it and make bread cakes. Abraham also ran out to the herd and took a tender and choice calf and gave it to the servant, and he hurried to prepare it. And he took curds and milk and the calf which he had prepared and placed it before them. And he was standing by them under the tree as they ate. So that's our example of hospitality. And you can see he was a very hospitable fellow. The first verse of this section makes it very clear that this is an appearance of God. It says flat out, 18:1, Now the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre. So it says right up front that this is an appearance of God. Now the second verse shows that it took place in the form of a visit of three men. Because verse 2 says, When he lifted up his eyes and looked, behold, three men were standing opposite him. So it's a visit from God, but it takes place in the form of three men. Jesus Christ and two angels are who these three men are. Notice, it doesn't say they walked up, it doesn't say they rode up, it doesn't say they ran up, it doesn't say how they got there at all. Abraham's just sitting there at his tent, and he's got his head down, and he looks up, and there they are, opposite him. That's the idea, because it says, when he lifted up his eyes and looked, behold, three men were standing there. So there they were, in other words. Now, Abraham, I believe, sensed that these guys were more than ordinary visitors. Now, granted, people in that time were very, very hospitable. And what Abraham does is not really uncommon. It was very common back then to be hospitable to strangers. Now, we don't understand that mindset. We have chain locks on our door. When somebody comes to the door, we peek through I'm not putting that down. I mean, we live in a society where, you know, you might get your door pushed in, and so we're very careful. But in that society, they were very hospitable to strangers. So if a stranger came up, Abraham did what was normal for the time. But I think his reaction goes a little bit further than mere hospitality. The word bowed, for example, is the Hebrew word shachah. That's a good one to say when you have a cold. And that means bow down in homage or worship. So I think he had an idea that these guys were something special when he ran out and bowed down to them. And he addresses their leader as Adonai, and you know, Adonai is one of the names of God in the Old Testament in Hebrew. So, although it is used of people, I'll grant that, it is used of people, but he seems to sense that there's something very special about these three men. In verse 3, he says, "My Lord, if I have now found favor in your sight, please do not pass your servant by." So he calls himself his servant. Verse 6 through 8 indicate that he was more than being hospitable here. It says in verse 6, "So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah and said, 'Quickly, prepare three measures of fine flour, knead it, and make bread cakes.' And Abraham also ran to the herd and took a tender and choice calf and gave it to the servant, and he hurried to prepare it. And he took curds and milk and the calf which he had prepared and placed it before them. And he was standing by them under the tree as they ate." So he's standing right over them while they're eating. You know, that seems to indicate that Abraham wanted to get the amenities over so they could get down to why they were there, to the business. Do you get that sense of the hurrying there? It's possibly just hospitality, possibly. He was trying to hurry up and get them fed so he could find out what was going on, basically. But nonetheless, Abraham stood by ready to do whatever they wanted to do. Now, the purpose of their visit, what was it? Sarah's reassurance in verse 9 through 15. Let's read those verses. Verse 9 says, "And then they said to him, 'Where is Sarah, your wife?' And he said, 'There in the tent.' He said, 'I will surely return to you at this time next year, and behold, Sarah, your wife, will have a son.' And Sarah was listening at the tent door, which was behind him." Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in age. Sarah was past childbearing. Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "After I have become old, shall I have pleasure? My Lord being old also?" And the Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh, saying, 'Shall I indeed bear a child when I am so old? Is anything too difficult for the Lord? At the appointed time I will return to you, at this time next year, and Sarah will have a son.' Sarah denied it, however, saying, 'I did not laugh,' for she was afraid. And he said, 'No, but you did laugh.'" So Sarah's reassurance now shows us that the visit was primarily intended for Sarah. This visit was to assure her that this was going to come to pass. Now, when Jesus Christ, or Jehovah, the Lord, as it says in verse 1, was made the announcement to her in verse 10, where it says that he, behold, Sarah, your wife, will have a son. When that happened, Sarah was at the tent door, and Jesus, Jehovah, the visitor, was standing out front, so he couldn't see her, I mean, to her mind. So when she laughed thinking that nobody would know, because she laughed to herself. She just kind of probably giggled and said, come on. You know, this is impossible. It'll never work. So the promise in verse 10 would clearly take a miracle. There's no getting around that. She was past menopause. He was 99 years old. And here comes a visitor and tells them that they're going to have a child by next year. So think of what you would think in similar circumstances. And Sarah, not only was she past menopause, but she couldn't even have kids when before. She was barren when she was a young woman. So it's kind of a double whammy. There's no possible way this could happen. Absolutely impossible. The promise would require a miracle of regeneration, wouldn't it? I mean, you pass menopause, you can't have kids. Well, God can do anything. That's why God himself made that promise. That's why he appeared to Abraham and Sarah, because it's his word, and his word is sure. Sarah resisted. In verse 10 through 15, we read about Sarah's resistance, but in verse 13 and 15, she gets convinced. In verse 15, it says, Sarah denied it, however, saying, I did not laugh, for she was afraid. And he said, no, but you did laugh. So she realizes that, yeah, this guy knows what's going on. He is an omniscient being. Remember when Abraham laughed? He wasn't reprimanded. Abraham laughed because his laughing was an outburst of his astonishment over what God had promised. Oh, this is just the greatest thing in the world. It's so wonderful and so unexpected that he laughed when God promised him. So Abraham's laughter was not reprimanded, but her laughing was the result of unbelief and doubt. She was being cynical. How do I know that? How do I know they were different? Well, because God reprimanded Sarah, and he didn't Abraham. So Abraham's laughter was just an outburst of joy, of excitement. And Sarah, when she laughed, she was being cynical. And you can see that in the context. She said, she laughed to herself, saying, after I have become old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? Can't happen. Never going to happen. It's impossible. It would take a miracle. And not only a miracle, but a miracle of regeneration. So she laughed out of unbelief and doubt. And her doubt was broken down by the reproof. How do I know that? Hebrews 11:11, remember? What did it say? She bore a son in faith. She had her son in faith. So the message got through to Sarah. The mission was successful for her because she did conceive a son in faith. Now in verse 14 is what Morris, Henry Morris, calls one of the mountain peak verses of the Bible. Verse 14 says, is anything too difficult for the Lord? That's one we should constantly keep in mind. Is anything too difficult for the Lord? Of course, it's a rhetorical question. That what that means is to ask the question is to answer it. Of course, nothing is too difficult for the Lord. Why? Because he created everything. And if he created everything, then he can change his creation. Just like if you make something, if you make Ray, for example, recently made me a model of a B-17. He can change that if he wanted to, because he made it. And that's how God is. He's the one that created the laws of nature. So can he change those laws of nature? Of course he can. We call that uniformity of cause and effect in an open system, is how we put it. Now, scientists believe in uniformity of cause and effect in a closed system, so they say. But do you know that scientists say that the singularity, you know what the singularity is? It's that little cosmic egg that exploded in the Big Bang. That the singularity exploded because of the a fluctuation in an eternal energy field that did not act according to the laws of physics as we know them. So what are they saying? They're saying this thing exploded because of a supernatural energy field. What's the difference between a supernatural energy field and a supernatural personal creative God? There's one big difference. That supernatural energy field can't talk. So that leads the scientists up to their own devices when it comes to morality or anything else for that matter. But our personal creator God, he did talk. He wrote us a book. So we have somewhere to go. Now, next time somebody tells you you're one of those crazy Christians who has faith in this God, I don't have that. I believe in the Big Bang and evolution. Tell them, well, if you believe in the hot Big Bang theory, you know, you must believe in that eternal supernatural energy field that caused it to explode because it fluctuated. They have as much faith as we do. Never, ever let anybody convince you that they're talking science versus the Bible, because that's not true. That is not what it is. Because they have as much faith in their religion, called evolutionism, as we do in ours, sometimes more. Now, the announcement of judgment. That's the second reason the angels came, remember? And that's in verse 16 to 33, just a word about the wrath of God, and that's what we'll be seeing in these verses. The wrath of God and Sodom are connected in that Sodom is used as an example of God's wrath again and again. And it's used three ways to teach us about God's wrath. The first way is God's wrath in time. Because God has a wrath in time. Look at 2 Peter 2:6. In 2 Peter 2:6, it says, if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example to those who would live ungodly lives thereafter. So they're an example of God's wrath in time. It's not talking about eternal judgment there. It's talking about fiery destruction in time. And it also talks, it teaches us about God's wrath at the second coming. Look at Luke 17. Luke 17. In verse 29 and 30, it says, but on the day that Lot went out from Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. It will be just the same on the day that the Son of Man is revealed. We'll see how he relates that destruction to the second coming of Jesus Christ. And it's also used as an example of hell in Jude, verse 7. Jude, verse 7 says, just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they, in the same way, used, indulged in gross immorality and went after strange flesh, are exhibited as an example in undergoing the punishment of eternal fire. So they're used as an example of hell itself. So we're in a very important section back in Genesis chapter 18, talking about this judgment. Now back to Genesis 18, we see the revelation to Abraham in verse 18, or chapter 18, 16 through 22. So let's read those. Starting at verse 16, it says, then the men rose from there and looked down toward Sodom, and Abraham was walking with them to send them off. The Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do? Since Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed. For I have chosen him so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken about him. And the Lord said, the outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great, and their sin is exceedingly grave. I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to its outcry, which has come to me. And if not, I will know. Then the men turned away from there and went toward Sodom, while Abraham was still standing before the Lord. So the revelation to Abraham has a basis. In fact, there's 3 points involved. First is Sodom is the focus of attention here. And I say that because, and I point that out because it says they looked down toward Sodom in verse 16, then the men rose up from there and looked down toward Sodom. That's an idiom in Hebrew. Look down toward Sodom means that's the focus of attention. It means everybody focus your attention down there towards Sodom. It's an idiom. And the certainty of God's action also, it says in verse 17, the Lord says, shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do? Now that about to do is put in by the translators because it hasn't come to pass yet. But actually, if you look in the Hebrew, it's a kel participle. And what that means is it's might be better translated, I am doing, rather than I am about to do. It says, I'm not going to hold back from Abraham what I am doing. So God's judgment is certain. He's in the process of it already. And then the third consideration is the place of Abraham. Why is God telling Abraham this? Well, because he will become a great nation, because he will be the source of universal blessing. Verse 18, since Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed. For I have chosen him. And that's why God is revealing to Abraham what's about to happen. Because he's God's chosen guy, and God isn't going to keep any secrets from him. It's like us. You know, we're God's chosen people, and he doesn't keep any secrets from us. He gave us the book. He gave us the Bible and told us all about himself. He tells us in here everything we need to know. We call that the doctrine of sufficiency. Doctrine of sufficiency is simply this. The Bible is what the believer needs, and it's all the believer needs as a rule of faith and practice. As a rule of faith and practice. Now, that doesn't discount science. It doesn't say that anything else is wrong. All it says is that if you want to know how to act And if you want to know how to direct your faith, then the Bible is what you need, and it's all you need. So the Bible is a rule of faith and practice. And I believe that firmly, right down to my toenails, that the Bible is what the believer needs, and it's all the believer needs. You don't need me to tell you what to do. A lot of preachers will preach on Sunday mornings, and they'll jump up and down and tell people what to do and point their finger and shake their finger and try and get them to do this and to do that, and we have to get our people. I don't need to do that, because my job is to get this Bible from this book to your ears in an understandable way. Now, there's some problems there, problems of different cultures, problems of different languages that the Bible was written in. That's why I work so hard on these classes, because I need to get it in a way that you can understand easily, I hope. So, consideration for the place of Abraham. That's why God told him what he was about to do. Now, he also gives justification for this judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah. Why is he going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah? Well, in verse 20, we have the fact of the matter when it says, "And the Lord said, the outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great, and their sin is exceedingly grave." God is sensitive to a social sin outcry, as he calls it. Look up in James chapter 5. In James chapter 5 and verse 4, it talks about this outcry of sin. When it says, "Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields, and which has been withheld by you, cries out against you. And the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth." So the outcry of sin has reached God's ears. And that's the way it is back in Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, obviously, God is omniscient. He knows everything. But there's a point where sin comes to when God tells us. He puts it in terms we can understand. He said, "It's come to my ears." Now, obviously, he knew about it before, but he's being kind to us, condescending, we call that, by telling us in a way that we can understand, that he knows the sin is crying out, so to speak. And the second point back in Genesis 18 is that it was a grave in verse 20. Their sin is exceedingly grave. So that's the justification for God's destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now the question is, well, yeah, God says that, but how do we know it? Well, the proof is in verse 21. Verse 21 says, "I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to its outcry, which has come to me. And if not, I will know." This is an amazing verse, isn't it? God is omniscient. He knows everything. Why did he go down to look? Why did he do that? We call that condescension. He wants us to know. I don't do this just on a whim. You know, he condescends to use a method that we would understand as humans. Something we can't understand omniscience, but what can we understand? He conducts an investigation. Now that's something we can understand, right? God went down there and conducted an investigation. He condescended to do that to show that Abraham, and Abraham knew that God was just in his judgments, and we'll see that in a minute. But he condescended to do that. He said, "Okay, if you know, just to show you I'm being just in destroying these two cities, I'm going to conduct an investigation." Now, we get down to the bartering stage In verse 23 says, Abraham came near and said, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you indeed sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous and the wicked are treated alike. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly? Now, Abraham is not asking this question for the sake of information. He's not asking it because he doesn't know. Obviously, verse 25 says, far be it from you to do such a thing. He knows God is just in his judgments. Now, he starts downward with 50 righteous, and he keeps counting down, as you all know, in verse 26. Says, so the Lord said, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare the whole place on their account. And then verse 27, Abraham replied, now behold, I have ventured to speak to the Lord, although I am but dust and ashes. Suppose 50 righteous are lacking five. Will you destroy the whole city because of five? And he said, I will not destroy it if I find 45 there. And he spoke to him yet again and said, suppose 40 are found there. And he said, I will not do it on account of the 40. And then he said, oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I shall speak. Suppose there's only 30 found there. And he said, I will not do it if I find 30 there. And he said, now behold, I have ventured to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there. And he said, I will not destroy it on account of the 20. And then he said, oh, my Lord, do not be angry, and I shall speak only this once. Suppose 10 are found there. And he said, I will not destroy it on account of the 10. And as soon as he had finished speaking to Abraham, the Lord departed, and Abraham returned to his place. So he starts counting downwards from 50, and he gets down to 10. He is not bartering with God here. He's not trying to make a deal with God. He's showing us how righteous God is. It's a lesson for us. How righteous is God? Will he destroy Sodom and Gomorrah if there are 50 righteous people there? No. Will he destroy the... Will he destroy this, the righteous along with the wicked? You know, if we would stop here at 10, and that's where Abraham stopped, isn't it? He said, there's 10 righteous. And he said, I won't destroy the city even if there are 10 righteous. You know what? If we left it there, he would have destroyed the whole city because there weren't even 10. How many were there? How many did there end up? You remember? Look at 19:16. 19:16 says, but he hesitated, so the men seized his hand and the hand of his wife and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon them, and they brought him out and put him outside the city. So Lot, his wife, and two daughters, four, and those they had to drag out. They didn't even want to come out. So God is impeccably righteous. He will not deal out judgment on those who don't deserve it. Now, Abraham prayed in verse, this whole thing is Abraham's prayer with God, his conversation with God. And you know what? Abraham's prayer had nothing to do with saving Lot and his family. He stopped at 10. He didn't even get down to the bare bones four that were actually righteous or chosen in Sodom. He stopped at 10. So Abraham's prayer didn't have anything to do with it. It's to teach us. It's to teach us that God is impeccably righteous. And if Abraham had kept his mouth shut, God would have done exactly the same thing, because he brought out the righteous. The four that were righteous, Lot, his wife, and two daughters. from the city of Sodom. And we'll look at the doom of Sodom next time. Father, thank you for your word, and thank you for these lessons you're teaching us in the Old Testament. We pray that we can understand them correctly so that we can make our decisions based on them, and with the help of the Holy Spirit, lead lives that are pleasing to you. In Christ's name, amen.